Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. As with the first hour, next hour, Jimmy Akin with questions from the internet. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Lots and lots of questions from the internet. And Jimmy, you did it again. You came back for the second hour. Thus far, you have never failed to show up for second hour.
Well, that was the plan.
Well, thanks.
So,
well, thanks for following
through.
Yeah. Thank you for following through on the plan. All right, back to questions we go. And I want to get to this first one because I know this is something that you have given a great deal of thought to, actually, this question. Samuel asks, do you think that the Olivet Discourse in the Synoptic Gospels refers primarily to the end of the world or the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70? If the former, how do you harmonize with Jesus, this with Jesus' promise that these things will occur within this generation? If it is the latter, how do we disentangle this imagery from St. Paul's discussion of the Lord's return and the church's understanding of the coming of Christ at the end of history? This is something that was early on a stumbling block for me. Over the years, I've given it a great deal of thought and have my own solutions, but I'm interested in your take. Thanks.
Okay, so this deals with the interpretation of Bible verses, and the Catholic Church does not have an official commentary on the Bible, so it primarily leaves questions of this nature to individual scholars, exegetes, to try to figure out. And I've done a lot of work on this, where St. Paul's discussion principally is engaged is in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And I've actually written a commentary on those. So I've worked through them in detail. The commentary isn't published, so I can't, just recommend that you get a copy. But I have worked through them in detail. I've also worked through the Olivet Discourse in the Synoptic Gospels in great detail. And I actually have a talk that I gave at last year's Catholic Answers Conference on the Olivet Discourse. For people who may not be familiar with that term, it's a speech or discourse that Jesus gave on the Mount of Olives. That's why it's called the Olivet Discourse. And he gave it right before the crucifixion. And I think in Mark and Luke's version of it, by the way, this talk is going to be coming out. It's not out yet, but it will be coming out on video on YouTube and stuff. So you can check my YouTube channel in the future. It may actually be out by the time this airs. But in Luke and Mark's version of the Olivet Discourse, it is set up, actually all three, Matthew included, are set up after Jesus and the disciples have just come out of the temple. And the disciples are noting, wow, what impressive buildings and stones, the temple is made out of. And Jesus says, yeah, you know what? They're all going to get torn down. And so then they cross the Kidron Valley. They go over to the Mount of Olives. And the disciples are like, we need a little bit of closure on that. Can you tell us more about the destruction of the temple and what's going to be the sign that the temple is going to be destroyed? And that in Mark and Luke's version, that's the only question on the table. They do not ask about anything but the destruction of the temple. And so to me, the natural way to read Mark and Luke's versions of the Olivet Discourse is it's in that generation, and it did. It happened in AD 70.
Jimmy, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You cut out for just a quick sec. So you said the only way to read, and then you cut out. I apologize for that.
Okay. So the natural way to read it, to my mind, is it's all about the destruction of the temple. That's the only question on the table. So that's what Jesus is discussing. And it did happen within that same generation. Jesus gave the Olivet Discourse in AD 33, and the temple was destroyed in AD 70, less than 40 years later. So it was within that same generation. In when we come to Matthew, though, Matthew's version is a little different. The disciples in Matthew's version not only ask about the destruction of the temple, they also ask about the end of the age. And so I think that Matthew combines two topics. It does contain material primarily in chapter 24 about the Matthew, we have these parables that seem to very clearly relate to the end of the world. So I think there's a transition in Matthew between the material that deals with the temple and the material that deals with the end of the world. And you could debate exactly where the transition line is, but I think that Matthew signals that there is a transition by reframing the question so that they're not just asking about the destruction of the temple. They do ask about that, but then they ask about something else too. When it comes to St. Paul's discussion of all this in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians principally, I think that part of the issue is St. Paul didn't, and especially at the beginning of his ministry as an apostle, he didn't have all the information that he would later. And so, especially early on, especially in the Thessalonian letters, St. Paul is assuming that Jesus is coming back within his own lifetime. You know, he talks about how the dead will be raised when Jesus comes back, he says, but we who are alive and remain will be caught up to be with Jesus. And so he's envisioning himself, because he says we, as still being alive when Jesus comes back. So he tended to think that the end of the world was going to happen in his lifetime. Now, he later learned that's not the case, because when you read 2 Timothy, it's very clear to Paul that he's about to die. He knows he's about to die. He's talking about, I've finished the race, and there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness and stuff like that. So he knows the second coming isn't going to happen in his lifetime. And before the close of the New Testament, it was revealed that there would be a lengthy period before the second coming. That's indicated in John's book of Revelation, where he has this long period symbolized as 1,000 years. Before the end of the world. And so when you're looking at St. Paul's discussion of the end of the world in the Thessalonian letters, it's carrying certain assumptions that St. Paul has at that moment in his ministry that later get clarified. And so so I would say that there are going to be things at the end of the world, like the man of lawlessness and so forth, that St. Paul talks about. And he initially assumed the man of lawlessness would be around in his day. And there is a sense in which the principles of lawlessness do manifest in Paul's day, but they haven't yet reached their culmination and won't yet reach their culmination until the end of the world, which it was later revealed would be further into the future. However, except for Matthew 25, and even in Matthew 25, the man of lawlessness is not mentioned. And so so I don't see any fundamental conflict between St. Paul's understanding of things and the Olivet Discourse. Paul's early on is making some assumptions that later get clarified, but there's no fundamental conflict here.
All right. Thank you. Very, very good. Interesting question, Samuel. Thank you. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place. All free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The questions are from the internet today. People sometimes assign themselves interesting names on the internet, which gives me more anxiety than it should because sometimes I think there are hidden messages I'm supposed to be getting. But Oni Leaf Nin is next. All right, I'm going to guess no hidden message in that. When the Eucharist is transubstantiation, excuse me, I beg your pardon, Oni asks, when the Eucharist is transubstantiated, what happens at the level of atoms? If the whole Christ is present in the Eucharist, why do some Eucharistic miracles, when examined, only reveal one part of the body, like heart tissue?
Okay, so let's deal with the second question first. It's true that, you know, some Eucharistic miracles only seem to, like, display heart tissue or something. Now, we know, as a matter of dogma, actually, that the entire Christ is contained under both species in the Eucharist. So the entire Jesus is really there under either the host or any portion of the precious blood. The entire Jesus is really there. But we don't see that in the cases of these Eucharistic miracles. And so what I would infer is that the Eucharistic miracles are only showing us a part of Christ because it will be more meaningful. And so if showing us heart tissue rather than, you know, skin, mm-hmm. or something, it's because that will be more meaningful to the people. The purpose of Eucharistic miracles is to inspire people's faith in Christ, and showing heart tissue is going to do that more than showing some other body part. And so that's how I would answer that question. When it comes to the first question, when transubstantiation happens, what happens on the level of atoms? Well, in order to, you know, settle that question, you'd need to get an electron microscope and look at the individual atoms of a host or wine, both before and after the consecration. And as far as I know, nobody has done that. Among other things, it would require getting special permission to do that, because God did not give us the Eucharist in order to look at it under an electron microscope. That's not its purpose. And so you would at least need, you know, permission from a bishop or something to even do that. And as far as I know, no one's ever done that. But so what I'm about to say is speculation, but I think it's very well-informed speculation. We have on a recognition in church teaching that when transubstantiation occurs, it does not affect the appearances of bread and wine. Even though it's really Jesus now, the appearances of bread and wine remain. And that is, seems to be the case for everybody, no matter how sharp your eyesight is. So some people are nearly blind, but it still looks like a host, still looks like bread to them. And and some other people have much sharper eyesight, and it still looks like bread to them. And it's still, even more to the point, the precious blood still smells like wine. Now, smell, our olfactory sense, is a chemical sense. And it is dependent on very small particles being transmitted through the air, which then get picked up and analyzed by the olfactory bulbs in our noses. And even after the transubstantiation happens, it still smells like wine. So what that tells us is that there are very small particles coming off of the Eucharist. Now, these are so small, they would no longer have the real presence, because it has to appear to be bread and wine not just smell like wine, but it has to look like drinkable wine in order to retain the real presence. If it's too small to do that, it no longer has the real presence. But what this shows us is microscopic particles that used to have the real presence still are perceived by our bodies as if they're wine. And so that allows us to extend the appearances principle, that it still appears to be bread and wine, down to the microscopic level. And so if you can extend that to the microscopic level that our noses are capable of detecting, I would propose that you'd see exactly the same thing before and after the consecration under an electron microscope. And so if you used a microscope powerful enough to detect individual atoms, you would see the same atoms both before and after the consecration. So there's not a change on the atomic level. Jesus is really present there, but we continue to see the same atoms that are there before the consecration. And so one way you might want to put this is there's not a physical change in the properties of the elements that are consecrated. They retain all of their same physical properties, but instead there's a metaphysical change that occurs deeper than the level of the physical properties, where Jesus is really present, and the substance of bread and wine are no longer present. But that's happening on the metaphysical level that's below the level of the physical properties.
Oni, thank you. Thanks very much for the question. This next one comes from McLaren. Are people who suffer from agoraphobia required to attend Mass in person?
Okay, so agoraphobia is kind of a fear of being in an open place. So, various people have, different kinds of phobias, like acrophobia is fear of being in a high place. Agoraphobia is like fear of being exposed in an exposed place. And so what the church's law is that we have, under ordinary circumstances, an obligation to attend Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation or the evening of the preceding days, unless a good reason prevents that. And one of the things that the church notes in its law is that some physical conditions, some illnesses, are reasonable excuses not to go. And on those days, you simply don't have an obligation. So if, for example, you got the flu or got a cold, you are not required to go. And in fact, I would say don't go, because you don't want to infect other people. That is not a loving thing to do, to put other people's health at risk. Even if you're healthy and don't think much of a cold, there are going to be people at church who have more fragile immune systems and who are elderly and who may not be able to handle a cold or the flu the way you can. So you need to think about other people and not expose them to unnecessary risks. So if that principle is true of physical illnesses, the same thing is going to be true of mental illnesses like phobias. So if someone has a phobia, whether it's agoraphobia or anything else, that is sufficiently strong, then it becomes an excuse, a legitimate excuse, not to attend Mass. For people who have that condition, they simply wouldn't have an obligation to go to Mass on those days, the same way a person with a physical illness wouldn't have an obligation to go to Mass on those days. Now, if one has just a touch of agoraphobia, where you go outside of your home and you're feeling a little bit exposed, but it's not a big deal, well, then you should go. That's an inconvenience, but we can shoulder a little bit of inconvenience in order to go to Mass. However, if it would result in a panic attack, then no, you don't got to go. I would suggest trying to get psychological treatment for agoraphobia that strong. And there are different therapies that can be used, particularly with cognitive behavioral therapy, to try to help overcome phobias. I would suggest, trying to get treatment to improve the condition so that you can live a normal life. It's not just about going to mass. Having agoraphobia can be a crippling thing for people, and you don't want to live a crippled life if you can avoid it. So I would say get treatment so that you can live a more normal life, and hopefully the degree of agoraphobia or any other phobia one has will diminish to the point that one can go to mass, at which point the obligation kicks in again. But if you are suffering from severe agoraphobia or any other kind of phobia that's connected to going to mass, well, it would constitute a valid reason not to go during the period that you're suffering from that extreme form of it. But we don't want people to be unhealthy. We want them to get over the cold. We want them to get over the flu. And we want them to get over agoraphobia so they can live normal, happy, healthy lives.
Thanks, McLaren, for the question. Oh, I remember this name. GermSil3 has asked you questions before when we've done this format. Internet questions for Jimmy Akin today. God is unchanging, GermSil3 says, but chose to create and currently causes creation to persist. Doesn't that mean he will always have chosen to create it?
Well, you have to identify your frame of reference from the eternal now where God exists. Yeah, he always chooses to create and maintain creation in existence. So from that perspective, yes, that's true. From our perspective inside of time, we could say that, God is out there creating us in time, so he always chooses to create us. If you mean something else, though, does this mean God didn't have free will or doesn't have free will? No, it doesn't mean that. In his eternal now, God is freely choosing. Nothing compels God to create or to maintain creation in existence. It's his choice to create and to maintain creation in existence. So right now, in the eternal now, God is freely doing this. He's freely making the choice to create and to keep creation in existence. The mere fact that he always is doing that does not deny his freedom in doing it. But it is true that, yeah, he's always doing it.
All right.
And it's not going to change as a result, because he's in an eternal now, and whatever choices he makes, they don't change.
GermSil, thanks. Jimmy foreshadowed that Casanova Girl would be back. Here's another question from Casanova Girl. Will being well off financially jeopardize our relationship with God?
Well, if you just mean well off financially in the context of what our culture considers well off financially, it doesn't of itself create a problem. Merely having a reasonable amount or a quite good amount of material resources doesn't of itself jeopardize our relationship with God, but it can jeopardize our relationship with God if we don't handle it correctly. If we only think about ourselves, so we're behaving selfishly rather than lovingly, well, then that can jeopardize our relationship with God. Or if we are, if we're tempted to focus on, gaining more and more financial resources, or failing to use them the way we should, well, then those things would be sins. And an obvious case is, like, let's say you start cheating on your taxes or do an insider trade-in or stuff like that, illegal things in order to get more money. Or you have an obligation to, care for your family and others, but you just want to keep that money in the bank and you let your family starve or go without medical care or fail to take care of the ordinary things in life that they need. Or you have the ability to help other people outside of your family and you just consistently refuse to do so because you're a miser. Well, okay, those things will be sins, and they can, sufficiently strong sins, can jeopardize your relationship with God. But it's not the having of the wealth that's the issue. It's what you're doing to get it and then how you use it after you've got it.
All right. Thank you very much, Casanova Girl, for two questions. Let's go to In Turkey. In Turkey asks, Jimmy, when you and Jack Finnegan proposed Jesus died on the 3rd of April, AD 33, is that based on a holy Gregorian timeline from now stretching back to then? For example, does that mean on 3 April 2033 it will be exactly 2,000 years since Jesus' death? Or would that be slightly different? Thanks.
Okay, so Jack Finnegan is a biblical chronologer, and so that's what In Turkey is asking about. And this is actually a little bit of geeky stuff that biblical chronologers know, but that other people may not be familiar with. I'm a biblical chronologer, too. I've done a lot of work on biblical chronology, which is the study of figuring out exactly when things happened to the greatest degree we can. The way this works, because there was a shift between the Julian calendar and the Gregorian calendar, which was a refinement of the Julian calendar to make it more accurate over time. What chronologers do is they use the Julian calendar for dates when the Julian calendar was in effect, and they use Gregorian dates for after the Gregorian calendar came into effect. So when Finnegan or I says Jesus was crucified on April 3rd, that's April 3rd on the Julian calendar, not on the modern Gregorian calendar.
All right. Thanks, In Turkey. Right back with poor Jimmy Akin. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The internet will just not stop. More and more questions for Jimmy Akin from the internet. We've got a whole bunch of them collected here, and we're asking Jimmy. This one comes from Michael. What is the Catholic understanding of the promise of the Father, identified by the Apostle Peter as the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, of which Joel prophesied? Specifically, A, since Peter employed the is of identity when he said that being filled with the Holy Spirit and speaking in other tongues as the Spirit gives the utterance ability, is that which was spoken of, is that which was spoken of by the prophet Joel? B, what then is the relationship or application, appropriation to the individual in salvation, if any, from an apostolic Pentecostal?
Okay, so happy to help out here. Now, as I mentioned, the Catholic Church does not have an official commentary on every verse in the Bible. It generally leaves the interpretation of Bible verses up to scholars to figure out. So there's room for diverse opinions on these matters, but I can offer my thoughts. And I hope it's helpful. Jesus does in the Gospels, and he actually mentions a couple of verses. He mentions, you know, Jesus talking about the promise of the Holy Spirit in Luke 24, and also in John, you know, chapters 14 to 17. But then he refers to Acts chapter 2, where he says Peter employs the is of identity. And that's something that a lot of people may not be familiar with. The term is has several different senses. One is known as the is of existence. And that's when you use is in an intransitive fashion to refer to the fact that something exists. So I could say God is, by which I mean God exists. So that's the is of existence. Then there's the is of predication. And the is of predication occurs when I use the word is to describe the properties that something has. So if I say the apple is red, I'm predicating the property because it's in the predicate of the sentence. That's why it's called predication. I'm predicating the property red to the apple. If I say the apple is red. So that's the is of predication. Then there's what Michael refers to, which is the is of identity, where I assert the identity of two different things using the word is. Like if I say Batman is Bruce Wayne, I'm using the is of identity. I'm asserting that Batman and Bruce Wayne are the same person. Now, that's kind of a surface level analysis of kind of three of the major uses of is, but it can get deeper than that, because, and philosophers love to go deeper about stuff because, you know, well, is everything true of Bruce Wayne that's true of Batman? You know, I mean, like, not everyone who knows Bruce Wayne knows that he's Batman, and people who know Batman don't necessarily know that he's Bruce Wayne. So it would seem that there are some properties that Batman may have that Bruce Wayne does not have. So there are, like, let's say Commissioner Gordon does not know that Bruce Wayne is Batman. Well, he knows Batman and he knows Bruce Wayne, but he doesn't know that they're the same person. And so anyway, there are some fairly deep philosophical waters that analytic philosophers like me love to get into. Well, I think that when we read the passage that Michael's referring to in Acts chapter 2, Peter's use of is can look like the is of identity, but I think it's actually has a subtler shade of meaning. It's what I would call the is of fulfillment. So here's the passage in Acts. This is from Acts chapter 2, starting at verse 16. The apostles have just been speaking in tongues, and then Peter starts preaching to the crowd, and he says, talking about the speaking in tongues and so forth, this is what was uttered. So this is, there's the is, this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even on my male servants and female servants. In those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy, and I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor and smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the day of the Lord comes, the great and magnificent day. So that's the prophecy from Joel that Peter says is being fulfilled in their day. But it's not a strict is of identity where all the properties of one thing are found in the thing that it's identical with. And this has to do with the concept of fulfillment in the Bible. It is not a strict, it doesn't involve a strict identity between two things. So, for example, in Matthew, when Jesus goes to, as an infant, is taken to Egypt, or as a small child, is taken to Egypt and then brought back, Matthew tells us this fulfilled the prophecy, out of Egypt I will call my son. But if you go back and you look in the Old Testament at the passage where it says, out of Egypt I called my son, it's actually talking about Israel and the Exodus. In the original literal sense of the text, Israel is the son, and the Exodus is when God calls his son Israel out of Egypt. But Matthew is seeing a fulfillment beyond that in the life of Christ, where just like Israel went to Egypt and then got called out of it, so Jesus, as an infant, went to Egypt and got called out of it. And that led to a parallel where Matthew and Christians generally can see this prophecy as having more than one fulfillment. So what that means is the biblical concept of fulfillment, and I could demonstrate it with many other passages, but the biblical concept of fulfillment involves more than strict identity. And I would say that that's the kind of is that we have operative here in Acts chapter 2, where Peter says, this is what Joel prophesied. He means this fulfills what Joel prophesied, but he's not limiting what Joel said to what happened on the day of Pentecost. In fact, if you just look at the beginning of the part that is quoted from Joel, in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Okay, well, not all flesh had the spirit poured out on it on Pentecost. And your sons and daughters shall prophesy. Okay, maybe that happened in tongues on Pentecost. And your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Well, that didn't happen on Pentecost. So at least Luke doesn't mention it. He doesn't report the disciples in the upper room having visions or falling asleep and having a prophetic dream. So I would not look at this as the is of identity, but as the is of fulfillment. Yes, part of what Joel prophesies does happen on Pentecost, but it's not limited to happening on Pentecost. It also happens at other points in church history. And in fact, it happens throughout church history. So I would view what Peter says about Joel as now God has inaugurated the fulfillment of this prophecy, but it is not strictly identical with the events on Pentecost. So I would say it's actually a different kind of is, which I would term the is of fulfillment based on the biblical concept of prophetic fulfillment. So, but I would agree, yep, Pentecost is a partial fulfillment of the prophecy of Joel. In terms of the related question, what is the relationship or application to the salvation of an individual, if any? Well, I would say that ordinarily, charismatic gifts, including the gift of speaking in tongues, is given to people who are Christians and in a state of grace, meaning a state of salvation. But I can't say that it's limited to those people because, as we mentioned earlier in today's episodes, you can be exercising a charismatic gift without being in a state of grace. So there are Christians who have received a charismatic gift like speaking in tongues, and they can continue to exercise it even if they're in mortal sin. So it's not, even though it's ordinarily had when one is a Christian in a state of grace, it's not a sure sign that you're saved. Also, I would say it's not a necessary sign. I know that some in various Pentecostal groups will say you need to speak in tongues in order to be saved, but I just don't find that in the scriptures, especially given what St. Paul says about speaking in tongues in 1 Corinthians, where he indicates not everybody speaks in tongues. Now, the patch that's used to try to explain that in some Pentecostal circles is to say, oh, but you got to do it at least at the beginning. And then you may or may not continue to speak in tongues. But I just don't find that. Scripture doesn't ever say that you've got to do it. Mm. It is and was in the first century common to speak in tongues, especially in connection with becoming a Christian, but it's we don't have a statement that it's necessary. And so I would you know, have a difference there with some Pentecostals. Also, I should point out that this phenomenon of speaking in tongues, which is known alternately as glossolalia from the Greek word glossa, that means tongue, and lalia means speaking. It's also sometimes called xenoglossy. Xenos means foreign, and glossa means tongue. So xenoglossy is speaking in a foreign tongue. It's actually not limited to Christians. There are reports of people in other religions who have displayed glossolalia, where they spoke in another language they hadn't naturally learned. So it's not always associated with being a Christian. It is associated with being a Christian in some circumstances, and was particularly in the first century, but it has a looser relationship to salvation than one might think. And I hope that's helpful to Michael, and always happy to engage in dialogue with folks coming from other perspectives. And if I can be of further assistance, just let me know.
Thanks, Michael. Take a quick break, very quick break. Be right back with more internet questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama, is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, taking questions from the internet. And this one comes from Lauren, L-O-O-O-L-L-L, which, does that mean really laughing out loud? I don't know. But Lauren has this question. Since worship requires sacrifice, why did the angel in Revelation tell John not to bow down before him in worship, since that belongs to God alone? I would love an answer to this. Thanks.
Okay, so what Lauren's asking about involves the relationship between two different concepts, sacrifice and worship. And both the term sacrifice and the term worship get used in different senses. Now, the basic meaning of a sacrifice is something you give up. And in a religious context, it's something you give up to a deity, at least partially. You give it up to the deity. Worship is an English word that comes from a couple of roots in English. One of them is worth, you know, if something has worth or value. And ship means the state of having it. But what worship means in English is attesting to the value or worth that something has. And in recent times, it's come to be used for attesting to the worth that God has. And of course, God has infinite worth. So it's a different kind of worship than the worth that other people have. But you'll still find survivals of the older, more original meaning of worship in English in use, particularly in British English. So you may notice, for example, if you ever watch the original Star Wars movies, you know, the good ones, that Han Solo will refer to Princess Leia as your worship. And he kind of does it to annoy her, but you'll notice he's saying your worship. And that's actually a title that's used in Britain for various officials, like the Lord Mayor of a town may be referred to as your worship, or a judge might be referred to as your worship or something like that. And we wouldn't say it that way in American English, but we would say something similar like your worthiness. You know, we're attesting by saying your worthiness. We're attributing worth to the person. They are worthy. But the concept, what this illustrates is the concept of worship is not exclusively tied to God, and it's not exclusively tied to sacrifice. Remember, sacrifice is giving something up. So at least partially, you don't have it anymore. If you've sacrificed it, like if you sacrifice a sheep, you don't have the sheep anymore. Well, worship and sacrifice overlap. Now, in Greek, they don't have the word worship. Instead, they have another word, which is proskuneo. And it's based on the Greek root kuneo, which means to kiss. But when you add that pros in front of it, which means to, etymologically, it would mean to do it towards someone, it came to mean to pay that person honor, or to venerate them, or to worship them. And this concept is not linked at the hip to the concept of sacrifice, because you are kind of giving up some attention if you're venerating someone, but it's not a sacrifice in the strict sense. So you can kind of get the concept of sacrifice in there, but you don't need sacrifice in a literal sense in order to venerate someone or pay them honor. And one of the things we find is that there are a range of attitudes towards paying honor to someone, where in some passages, paying honor to someone other than God is totally fine. You know, St. Paul says, pay honor to whomever honor is due. On the other hand, we find these other passages like that use, you know, the same word, like where the angel twice in Revelation, an angel tells John not to venerate him because that's due to God. And it can be kind of confusing. Why do we have some passages where it's okay to pay honor to someone, and other cases where you're told, no, only do that for God? Well, partly it's based on the customs of the time. So like in some times, like bowing on the ground, prostrating yourself, putting your face down to the ground, that was considered an acceptable form of paying homage to someone, of honoring someone. You could do that for a king, for example. But in other situations, it was taken as a sign of divine worship. And so it's like, oh no, don't do that to me. I'm not God. And so what we find is the concept of honor or veneration or worship has different expressions in different times. And in some contexts, it's a given sign of veneration, like bowing down on the ground is with your face to the ground, is considered something that is fine to do to a human. In other situations, it's like, nope, that should only be done for God. And there's not a single expression that, or set of expressions that belong to divine worship compared to other forms of honor. And this is based on the fact that what you're doing with your body isn't what's important. It's what you're doing in your heart. If I were to bow down to a human being and put my face towards the floor and just meant to honor them in a human way, but did not mean to worship them as a deity, well, then what I'm doing is fine. You know, it's just what I'm doing with my body is just an expression of the attitude of my heart. On the other hand, if to me bowing down with my face to the ground means divine worship, then I absolutely should not do that to a person, because it's an expression of what I'm doing in my heart. And if what I'm doing in my heart is paying someone divine honor instead of human honor, then I shouldn't be doing that. So to kind of back up to Lauren's general question, worship and sacrifice are two concepts that intersect with each other, but there are forms of worship where you pay honor to someone even though you're not offering them a sacrifice. And sacrifice is thus one form by which you can pay honor to someone, but it's not the only form. It may be a form, since we're told to sacrifice the Eucharist, it's a form that you need to be part of proper Christian worship, but it's not the case that every act of worship or paying honor involves a sacrifice in any literal sense.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm going to keep going here, see how many we can get with Jimmy before we have to go. Hugh wants to know this. When the council selected the Gospels, did they reject Gospels that were accurate but added nothing to the other four? Were they aware of the, and he puts in quotes, relatively minor discrepancies among the Gospels? Excuse me, in parentheses.
Well, they certainly were aware of the differences between the four canonical Gospels. I mean, and you have church fathers discussing the differences between the four canonical Gospels, so they definitely knew about those. And they realized these don't alter anything fundamental, and these don't stop us from recognizing these as divinely inspired scriptures. When it comes to the Gospels that did not make it into the canon, some of them were rejected because they were written too late. Others were rejected because, so they couldn't be from the apostles or their associates. Others were rejected because they contained teachings that contradicted the faith that had been passed down from Christ and the apostles. But Hugh is asking something more specific. Did they reject Gospels that were accurate but didn't really add anything to the other four? And the answer to that is, we don't know. It's going to depend on what do you mean by didn't add anything, because if it's a different gospel, it's got something different in it. I assume he means didn't add anything major. And the answer to that is we don't really know, because we don't have all of the gospels that they rejected. In particular, there was one gospel that was not included by the councils, but that was debated among Christians about, is it scripture or not? It was known as the Gospel of the Hebrews. And Eusebius, writing in the early 300s, before these councils that started happening in the late 300s, he says it was one of the disputed books, that some many Jewish Christians used the Gospel of the Hebrews, but not everybody did. And among regular Christians who weren't Jewish, it was debated whether this Gospel of the Hebrews should be considered scripture or not. It appears that the Gospel of the Hebrews was largely kind of the same as Matthew's Gospel in content, but it also included some unique passages. Unfortunately, we don't have the Gospel to the Hebrews anymore. We've got some quotations from it, and it's a little bit different than Matthew, but you could, depending on how you apply the term, you could say, well, it didn't really add anything fundamental to Matthew. So that would be a possible candidate for a gospel that did not make it in, but that also seems to have been orthodox, at least broadly speaking, because early Christians were using it and not denouncing it as heretical. But it also seems like maybe it didn't add too much to what's in the others. So that's a possible candidate. But it's going to depend on what you mean by not adding, and we can't verify it ultimately because we don't have the text itself at this point.
Thanks, Hugh. Let's see if we can get Tony in here. If we can lose our salvation through mortal sins of omission, are certain good works necessary to retain our salvation? Isn't Jesus referring to mortal sins of omission that imperil salvation at the end of Matthew 25?
Well, yeah, there are situations in which one can omit doing an action in a way that's mortally sinful. Let's suppose I am perfectly able to save a person from starving to death on my doorstep, the way Lazarus did with the rich man, or he actually just died. But let's suppose he was starving. If someone is starving in my presence and I have more food than I need and I could easily give them food and keep them from dying, well, that if no one else is going to be doing it, that would be morally obligatory on me to do it. So there are situations in which refraining from doing a good act, thus a sin of omission, could jeopardize our salvation. And Jesus, you know, discusses some actions in that regard in Matthew 25, but you have to be careful because there are other things that can affect a situation. Like today we have a lot of welfare, and it's not obligatory on me to feed a starving person if they have other resources that they could use. So we have to approach this question with some nuance. But in principle, yeah, a mortal sin of omission would jeopardize your salvation.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks to everybody who got their questions in. We do this from time to time, so don't despair if we didn't get to your question. We might get to it another time. And if you've got a question for Jimmy, you can submit it to us, radio@catholic.com, or use one of Jimmy's contacts to get it to him. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for the 2 hours.
My pleasure.
All right, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Mysterious.fm, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check out the Jimmy Akin podcast. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.